Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer sessions of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the meeting over to your host, Dr. Haug. You may begin.
Thank you, Amber, and welcome everybody to today's NGS J6-JK open meeting. Next slide, please. Just as a note, this call is being recorded and transcribed and will be posted within a few weeks after the meeting. Next slide, please. On the next slide, you have a list of the NGS CMDs, Drs. Awadele, Boren, Burroughs, Cunningham, Dorden, myself, and McKinney. Next slide, please. These are the five policies up for comment today. Monitors will be the first discussed, and that's a new policy. The second will be percutaneous arteriovenous fistula for hemodialysis. That's also a brand new policy. The percutaneous vertebral augmentation for osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture is an existing policy that has some revisions to it that we'll have comments on. And then water vapor thermal therapy for LUTS BPH is also an existing policy that has a revision. Then finally, computed tomography cerebral perfusion analysis, CTP, is another brand new policy. Next slide. So as I said, the first policy up for discussion will be the implantable continuous glucose monitors, and Dr. Burroughs will be leading this discussion. Dr. Burroughs?
Thank you, Dr. Haug. Good afternoon. I'm going to give an overview of the implantable continuous glucose monitors. The Eversense continuous glucose monitoring system is the only FDA-approved implantable continuous glucose monitor. The device was initially approved by the FDA in 2018 with expanded non-adjunctive indications in June of 2019. The implantable continuous glucose monitor is a prescription device that provides real-time glucose monitoring every 5 minutes for up to 90 days, and it is designed to replace finger stick blood glucose testing for diabetes treatment decisions, as indicated in the FDA 2019 approval. Next slide, please. With respect to covered indications, therapeutic implantable glucose monitors are considered reasonable and necessary when all of the following coverage criteria are met. The beneficiary has diabetes mellitus. The beneficiary has been using a blood glucose monitor and performing frequent, defined as 4 or more times a day testing. The beneficiary is insulin treated with multiple, meaning 3 or more daily injections of insulin, or a Medicare covered continuous subcutaneous insulin infusion pump. And the beneficiary's insulin treatment regimen requires frequent adjustment by the beneficiary on the basis of a blood glucose monitor or continuous glucose monitor testing result. And within 6 months prior to ordering the implantable continuous monitor, the treating practitioner has an in-person visit with the beneficiary to evaluate their diabetes control and determine that criteria 1 through 4 above are met. Every 6 months following the initial prescription of the implantable monitor, the treating practitioner has an in-person visit with the beneficiary to assess adherence to their monitor regimen and diabetic treatment plan. With regards to limitations, next slide. With regards to limitation of coverage, the implantable monitoring devices will not be considered reasonable and necessary for individuals who do not require insulin therapy and short-term diagnostic use defined as 72 hours to a week is also not necessary. Next slide, please. Regarding analysis of evidence, if implantable continuous glucose monitors are shown to produce similar results to the current FDA-approved non-implantable therapeutic monitors, then implantable continuous glucose monitors will similarly improve health outcomes for these Medicare beneficiaries with diabetes on insulin. Objective criteria of this implantable device are similar to the external sensor therapeutic continuous glucose monitors, so coverage of this device will be in line with current continuous glucose monitoring criteria. We have two registered presenters. Amber, can you please open the line for Dr. Kaufman? Dr. Kaufman, I know your slides state this, but for the sake of the audio recording, can you please state your name, affiliation, and any conflicts of interest?
Certainly. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Thank you. My name is Dr. Francine Kaufman. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Senseonics, Inc., and I'm also a practicing pediatric endocrinologist. And my conflict of interest is that I'm an employee and a member of the board of directors of Senseonics. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present on the Eversense Continuous Glucose Monitoring System, the first long-term implanted CGM. I do want to state that the goals of the presentation is to describe the Eversense CGM system, its components, and then to show a case example of a patient requiring insulin in the Medicare age range. I do want to add that a number of Senseonics colleagues are on this call, including our president, Dr. Tim Goodnow. This slide conveys that continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, is considered the standard of care for type 1 and intensively managed type 2 diabetes. The American Diabetes Association, that amends their standards every year, has recommended CGM as a tool to improve glucose control and to mitigate hypoglycemia. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, or ACE, had their standards developed in 2016 and again saw the benefits of using CGM to improve glycemic control and to reduce both the cost and the medical consequences of severe hypoglycemia. And the Endocrine Society stated essentially the same in their 2016 standards, that CGM can be used to improve diabetes outcomes. Next slide. This slide describes the FDA indications for Eversense as a therapeutic CGM. It's indicated for adults for up to 90 days. The system provides real-time glucose readings every 5 minutes, glucose trend information, alerts to detect or predict episodes of high or low blood glucose. The data can be shared with up to 5 care partners in real time, and the data is retrievable by both patients and healthcare providers to adjust their diabetes regimen. The device is used as a non-adjunctive system to replace the information from standard blood glucose monitoring, and it does require calibration. Next slide. This slide shows the components of the Eversense CGM system. There's the sensor, which is fully implanted, the smart transmitter, which is worn over the sensor on the skin in place with a mild silicone-based adhesive. The information is seen on the mobile app of a smartphone, and as well, the cloud-based data management system is available. The sensor, again, lasts up to 3 months, is fully implanted. The transmitter has the unique feature of allowing for on-body vibratory alerts if the smartphone is not within the caring of the individual, and the transmitter can be easily taken on and off. Next slide. This slide describes how the Eversense system works. The on-body transmitter wirelessly powers the implanted sensor. The antenna on the sensor receives the energy and receives its power thereby. The indicator polymer on the sensor fluoresces when glucose is present in a reversible reaction. The sensor then sends back the raw data to the transmitter that actually calculates the glucose value. The value can then be seen on the mobile device where it's displayed, as well as trends and alerts can be shown. And again, this can be shared with up to 5 care partners in real time. The next slide. This slide shows the Eversense insertion and removal procedures, all done in a sterile field in the healthcare provider's office. To insert the sensor, a small 5-millimeter incision is made after numbing with local anesthesia. A sterile tool is inserted to create a pocket. The sensor is then placed in that pocket, and the skin is closed with Steri-Strips, and a small bandage is placed on top. For the removal procedure, again, done under sterile conditions, involving anesthetizing the area of the small 5 to 6 millimeter incision, inserting the clamp, grasping the sensor and removing it, and then the incision is closed with Steri-Strips and a small bandage is placed on top. Next slide. I wanted to share with you this example of how the system is used by a patient with intensively managed diabetes taking insulin. This is a report from the DMS system for a 71-year-old patient with longstanding diabetes. It shows that she wears a transmitter almost all of the time, therefore is able to obtain the glucose information almost all of the time, and that the glucose levels she achieves are remarkable. The glucose values in this DMS system are shown in multiple ways. First, there's an average glucose value. There's an estimation of the hemoglobin A1C from these glucometrics, and I do want to suggest that this has been of incredible value during the time of COVID when patients were either unable or unwilling to get a laboratory measurement of their A1C. You can see this patient's A1C is quite excellent, it's 6.3. And then you can see that the glucose information is then shown. The low values are shown, the in-target range is shown, and the high values are shown in addition. And there are targeted numbers for each of these values so that the healthcare provider and the patient can see how the patient is doing against established standards of care. The coefficient of variation and standard deviation show measures of glycemic variability. That's all you can see, the ambulatory glucose profile shows the median glucose value by time as well as a interquartile range. Next slide. And the next one after this. If I could just comment briefly on the coverage criteria, which we agree with. However, I do want to point out that many beneficiaries are performing blood glucose monitoring, as suggested, of 4 or more times a day. However, not all of them are able to do this. Some of them are already using a different CGM device and are no longer using blood glucose measurements with any frequency or even at all. Therefore, criteria 2 of the blood glucose testing of 4 or more times a day might not be met, so we are hoping that this criteria could be revised. I want to thank you for your attention and be more than happy to answer any questions you may have. And again, thank you on behalf of Eversense, the first long-term implantable CGM system.
Thank you, Dr. Kaufman, for that presentation. Our next registered presenter is Mr. Bushman. Amber, can you please open Dr. Bushman's line? Sorry, Mr. Bushman, I know that your slides state this, but for the sake of the recording, can you please state your name, your affiliation?
Yeah. Sure, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so first of all, a correction, I dropped out during my PhD program. I am not a doctor.
Sorry.
So my name is Jesse Bushman. I am the Senior Director of Health Policy with JDRF International. It's the leading charitable organization funding type 1 diabetes research, and its mission is basically to accelerate life-changing breakthroughs and look for a treatment and take care of people while we're looking for a cure. I have no financial relationship to the organization that manufactures the device that is the subject of this proposed LCD. JDRF strongly supports the conclusion of the proposed LCD that coverage of this device will be in line with current CGM criteria. There are more than 300,000 Medicare beneficiaries with type 1. The mainstay of type 1 disease management, insulin, has been around for about 100 years now. It's not a cure. There are significant unmet needs, and the disease management burden still exists today. People with type 1 and their caregivers are responsible for 24 hours a day and often minute-to-minute disease management needed to survive. And the exogenous insulin replacement that they use does not work the same as that created by their own bodies. and that leads to some significant challenges with glucose control and the increased risk for complications. Data published earlier this year from the T1D Exchange Clinical Registry tells us that less than a third of adults and only a fifth of children in the U.S. meet recommended glycemic targets as measured by HbA1c. The average patient spends 7 hours a day hyperglycemic and over 90 minutes hypoglycemic. In addition, real-world studies have estimated that most individuals with type 1 diabetes experience approximately 2 episodes of hypoglycemia each week and 1 severe event per patient per year. Because of the state of diabetes care, there is a need for technologies that can improve outcomes and meet the unmet needs of the type 1 population. Continuous glucose monitors have been proven repeatedly to improve outcomes in people with diabetes, specifically lowering their A1Cs. A study of older adults using CGM funded by JDRF was just published in JAMA on the 16th of this month, and it demonstrates that use of CGM in this population reduces incidence of hypoglycemia, increases time in range, and lowers A1C. Consequently, anything that we can do to encourage the use of CGMs will help improve outcomes and decrease the costly consequences of diabetes, including things like hypoglycemia and the more unpleasant long-term complications that Medicare largely pays for. JDRF knows from unpublished internal surveying that people with diabetes are very sensitive to variation in features of CGMs. Some will not use the devices if their specific features are problematic for them. Making another CGM option available to Medicare beneficiaries, like this proposed LCD will do, will increase the number of people who use a CGM, and this will have beneficial results. JDRF strongly supports the conclusion of the proposed LCD that implantable CGMs should be covered by Medicare, and we support the designation of the device as a physician service and its payment under the physician fee schedule. We would request 3 changes in the eligibility criteria. First, the proposal requires that beneficiaries be conducting at least 4 finger sticks per day in order to qualify for CGM coverage. We believe that that should be eliminated or reduced to no more than 3 finger sticks per day. People who are diabetic and using insulin 3 or more times per day will necessarily be testing their blood glucose levels each day. It's unnecessary to impose the testing as a requirement, as they'll already be doing that simply as a matter of taking care of themselves. Further, Medicare's standard coverage for test strips only provides for 3 test strips per day, and some major suppliers, for example, CVS, refuse to provide more than 3 test strips per day because of the challenges associated with obtaining documentation to demonstrate the need for larger numbers of test strips and the associated audit risk. Finally, subgroup analyses in 2 important studies concluded that there was no difference in the outcomes of CGM usage among those patients who had previously used 4 or more finger sticks and those who had tested with fewer than 4. An article reporting on these subgroup analyses concluded that, quote, there is no evidence that frequent SMBG or finger stick testing or type of diabetes is predictive of successful outcome with CGM use. The proposed LCD requires that the patient be treated with this is the second request that we make, and that is that the proposed LCD requires that the patient be treated with injections of insulin in order to receive coverage for a CGM. There is at least 1 form of inhaled insulin on the market. There are some suppliers who are leery about providing a CGM if the person is using inhaled insulin because of that specific word injection. So to accommodate that reality, we suggested the wording within the LCD be modified to require administrations of insulin. The 3rd thing that we would request is that the proposed LCD requires a visit with a prescribing professional at least every 6 months. The only implantable CGM on the market, the subject of this proposed LCD, must be replaced every 90 days. Therefore, patients will by default be seeing their professional who manages this service at least that frequently. The manufacturer of the device is working to get approval for a 180-day version of the device, which would still necessitate a visit with the prescribing professional every 6 months. In the case of this CGM, it would seem that a requirement that the patient visit with the prescriber at least every 6 months would be unnecessary since the nature of the device already requires that. Consequently, the inclusion of this as an eligibility requirement simply creates a paperwork burden for patients, providers, and suppliers that could be eliminated. If CMS chooses to retain that requirement for periodic visits and documentation of them, we believe that that requirement should be modified to require that documentation once per year and only more frequently if the provider and the patient determine that it's necessary. With that, I'd like to thank you for your time and the opportunity to talk today and present the views of JDRF.
Thank you, Mr. Bushman. We're now going to open the line for any additional comments on this draft policy. If you're on the line and you'd like to make a comment, when your line has been opened, please start off by stating your name, your affiliation, and any conflicts of interest. Amber, can you please open up the line for comments?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or you have a comment, please press star one. You will be prompted to record your name. Please be sure to unmute your phone. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question or you have a comment, please press star one. We'll pause for just a moment to allow those to start coming through. We have no questions or comments coming through at this time.
Okay. If there are no questions or comments, I think we can move on.
Thank you, Dr. Burrow. So we will close the open meeting comments on implantable continuous glucose monitors. The next policy to be discussed is percutaneous arteriovenous fistula for hemodialysis. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a new policy. An autogenous distal forearm AVF has been the gold standard for hemodialysis access since the fistula first campaign was launched by CMS in 2003. Unfortunately, up to 50% never become usable, especially in the elderly. A major cause of this is juxta-anastomotic stenosis due to neointimal hyperplasia, thought to be due at least in part to surgical trauma to the vessel and surrounding tissues. So a percutaneous approach to an AVF potentially minimizes this trauma. And this policy looks at two endovenous methods of creating a proximal forearm AVF. Next slide, please. Key outcome metrics out to 2 years show relative parity between surgical and endovenous approaches to proximal radial artery AVF using the ellipsis system. And so we believe that it should enjoy comparable indications as a second access option after a so-called wrist fistula. The proposed LCD does not cover the wavelength system due to ongoing safety issues and limited longer-term data. Next slide. I believe these coverage criteria for PAVF are pretty self-explanatory and relatively non-controversial. The main point of contention probably will be the non-coverage of the wavelength device itself. Okay, next slide. We have four registered speakers for this policy. The first is Dr. Wasi. Dr. Wasi, operator, if you could open his line. Dr. Wasi, are you able to speak?
Yeah, yes, I'm here, and I'm a female, as you'll recognize from my voice. That's all right. My name is Moni Wasi. I'm an interventional nephrologist here at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. I'm the current past president of the National Society, which is known as the American Society of Diagnostic and Interventional Nephrology. And my conflicts today, COI, I'm a consultant for Avenue Medical and Dioxamed, and then a speaker for WL Gore and Medtronic. We can go ahead with the next slide. Thank you. So I wanted to give the audience today, first of all, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm really doing this on behalf of our patients, our dialysis patients, and I wanted to give the audience today a clear idea of what the potential benefits are for percutaneous fistula. So just by way of background, for those of you who aren't quite as familiar with dialysis access, these first two slides will get you there. What many of you know, the surgical AV fistula is really the preferred form of vascular access, largely due to its lower frequency of stenosis, thrombosis, and infection. But the real sticking point for surgical AV fistulas are that the outcomes tend to be variable and can be quite poor. And up to 60% of surgical AV fistulas, in fact, fail to mature for use, as has been determined in one to two of the large studies that have been conducted by the NIH. Moreover, surgical expertise is widely variable and regional, and in many cases, fistula can require several, one to two, maybe three interventions in an effort to try and promote maturation and prepare them to be able to be usable for dialysis. All the while that this is occurring, patients who initiate dialysis do so via a catheter, and protracted use of a catheter clearly places them at increased risk of infection and central stenosis. Next slide, please. So I think it's important to emphasize what this protracted use and the length of time that it can actually take to get a fistula, what it can actually be. Studies done, I'll be presenting two of these just very briefly. One done in Birmingham showed that amongst those individuals who started dialysis with a catheter, timing was marked from the time at which the patient actually got their first surgical appointment to the time at which they actually started to use their fistula. And as you can see on the right, that time is substantial. The time to first access surgery was nearly 5 months from the referral point, and time to first use amongst this patient group was up to 1 year. So all of the efforts that these patients go through to try and get a fistula can take a tremendous amount of time to occur, largely because of their surgical, many of the steps that the patients have to go through in an effort to get this done, as well as the fact that surgeons are often very busy and have other types of surgeries that they conduct. Next slide, please. When the same evaluation was done in a group of patients that actually hadn't yet started dialysis, those patients with chronic kidney disease stages 4 and 5, similar results were found. In fact, the time from nephrology evaluation to the surgical referral was nearly a month, and then the time to evaluation was another 52 days, and then the time to surgery was 30 days. That was nearly 3.5 months for a patient to go from evaluation by their nephrologist to obtaining a surgery for a vascular access. And this doesn't account for the time that it takes for the fistula itself to achieve maturation. So a substantial amount of time can pass before our patients are actually able to get a surgical fistula. Next slide, please. So you can imagine that nephrologists were all very excited about the fact that finally a new technology had come about. Knowing what the problems were and knowing what the amount of time it was that a fistula could take to even get placed. And that new technology is the percutaneous AV fistula creation, which will be discussed by both myself and then the next couple of speakers. Really, these devices allow patients greater access to fistula creation by placing AV fistula creation into the hands of interventionalists. And the idea here is that there can be then a reduction in the delays that many patients face, the repeated scheduling of office visits, and then the pre-surgical procedures that are oftentimes required by our surgical colleagues in advance of this procedure to be performed. Next slide, please. So, again, you'll be hearing more about this, but there are two current FDA-approved devices. One is the Wavelink, which is a dual catheter device using an RF electrode, and it's utilized under fluoroscopy in order to create a fistula. And then the second device is the Ellipsis, which is an ultrasound-guided single catheter electrocautery device that's placed under ultrasound. Next slide, please. So in general, these two technologies really focus on the use of vascular anatomy and the proximal forearm. And as a nephrologist, we like to use the distal arm as much as we possibly can in patients in an effort to try and afford them as many options over time, because oftentimes fistulas and grafts can run out or they no longer become usable. So we like to give patients as much of what we call vascular real estate as we possibly can, and we like to start as distal as possible. I think it's also important to note, though, that the use of the proximal forearm fistulas for vessels for fistula creation is not new. Kenneth Grotz first described the use of the proximal radial artery to perforate or vein fistula in 1977, And the Graz fistula is a surgical fistula that's been in use for many years. Next slide, please. So when we look to see what the two devices currently look like in comparison to a surgical fistula, there's a few things that are worth noting. The access type obviously is differentiated by the type of device that has been constructed, single puncture versus open surgical incision versus a dual puncture. And then the AV access creation method, one is a fused anastomosis such using the ellipsis device. Obviously, the surgical fistula is created using suture, and then the wavelength is used with a slit fistula with RF energy creation. Image guidance, as I've touched upon, includes ultrasound for the ellipsis device, and then ultrasound fluoroscopy, and then use of contrast for the wavelength device. Procedure time based on the two pivotal trials can vary from anywhere from 24 minutes to over an hour. And maturation time, you'll note, for the percutaneous devices, to date, appears to be significantly better than that of surgical fistula. The time to use for dialysis has been reported in the ellipsis device as being shorter than that of a surgical fistula. And then the cumulative patency for the two percutaneous devices are improved at 12 months beyond that of a surgical fistula. And the cumulative patency of an ellipsis device is around 91% compared to the surgical fistula of 64%. Adverse events vary anywhere from 0% up to 3%, as you can see there. And then you can see where the data originated for the pivotal trials for these two devices compared to that of surgical fistula historical studies. Next slide, please. So just briefly, it's worth covering the fact that not every patient is a suitable candidate for a percutaneous fistula. Eligibility in general for these devices includes anticipated life expectancy greater than a year, which I would say is probably similar to that for a surgical fistula. The individual should not be a candidate for a surgical wrist fistula because, again, as I mentioned, that's a territory that we'd like to start with. So if a patient has the anatomy to support that, that's the ideal starting point for a patient. This is an opportunity for a patient to get a fistula who wants to avoid open surgery. Those individuals who have no evidence of infection are potentially candidates, and then obviously ones that meet vascular parameters for their respective devices. And importantly, an adequate infrastructure needs to be in place to support thoughtful cannulation, whether the patient wants to do home hemodialysis and self-cannulate versus doing in-center dialysis. Next slide, please.
We're down to a minute in presentation, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Several ways by which the percutaneous fistula differs from a surgical fistula, as you can read there, but the one that I'll point out to is that currently it's less invasive, appears to have improved maturation and shorter cannulation time. Next slide, please. As you can see here, distal fistulas ideally are surgical, and as you move to the proximal forearm, that's when we employ the use of a percutaneous fistula. Next slide, please. So finally, potential advantages include reduced delays for fistula creation, the opportunity for more anatomical options for percutaneous fistula, and improvement in patient choice for procedures for those who wish to avoid open surgery. Thank you.
Dr. Wasi, thank you. Just a couple questions for you. Do you do both procedures?
I don't do both procedures. There are two or three interventional nephrologists in the U.S. that do both procedures, but in general, those of us who work at a hospital setting, oftentimes our interventional colleagues do one, or the interventional nephrologists do the other. There are obviously issues around the ability for the hospital to be willing to pay for both devices to have on formulary. So those are some things that are critical issues.
Do you have a preference?
The data so far is supportive, I think, of both. I think that what I would say is that I like long-term data, and I think the data that is best supported with long-term data suggesting fewer outcomes and, or fewer complications and good cannulation, that data is supported by the Ellipsis device. But I do know that many of my colleagues have used the Wavelength device and are having very good success with that in places around the country, including St. Louis and Dallas, Texas.
Do you think some patients would not be a candidate for Ellipsis but might be a candidate for Wavelength?
Yeah, I think based on the opportunities for both the 4 and the 6 French devices for the Wavelength, there's an opportunity to approach the arm. If we go back to one of my previous slides, gives the opportunity for a more distal creation with a Wavelength device. You can see there that in zone 2, the Wavelength would be ideal for a patient, and then the Ellipsis would use the proximal radial artery and the perforator, so it's slightly more proximal than the Wavelength. So, you know, if you're looking at it purely from an anatomic standpoint and choosing where the patient has their optimal vasculature and meets the criteria, the Wavelength actually is appropriate for certain patients and the Ellipsis is appropriate for others. This image came from Dr. Shevardayan, who's a vascular surgeon in Germany, and he actually uses both devices and oftentimes on his social media does in fact report that he's used the Wavelength in a patient and then subsequently gone on to use the Ellipsis device. So there is a role for both from what the data supports and for those practitioners that actually are presenting their data from time to time at our meetings.
Thank you, Dr. Wasi.
You're welcome.
Okay, our next registered speaker is Dr. Jennings. Operator, if you could open up Dr. Jennings' line.
Hello, this is William Jennings. I'm a professor of surgery with the University of Oklahoma here in Tulsa. Next slide. Disclosure policy, I do have a stock in the Avenue Medical with the Ellipsis device. Next slide. So these slides are a little tedious, but they're reviewing literature. So initially, this talks about some articles about surgical proximal radial artery fistulas, which has been a topic I've been interested in for several decades. I use this a lot when working with Larry Spergel. We did all the fistula first meetings for those many years, working on increasing the number of fistulas in the United States. The first article is a meta-analysis looking at proximal radial artery fistulas. It emphasized the very low risk of Steele syndrome, arm edema, and other complications associated with proximal radial artery fistulas versus brachial artery fistulas. The next paper is, number 2, was a publication from Boston by our next speaker and his colleague, Dr. Ozaki, prospectively looking at brachial versus proximal radial artery access, noting the much fewer risk of complications, adequate flow, and good functional success in both groups. And lastly, just a reference to an article of mine of a 10-year experience of about 1,400 proximal radial artery fistulas with primary patency at 24 months of and cumulative patency at 24 months of 91%. Certainly, these patients needed intervention to keep this going. However, the cumulative effect was excellent. Next slide. So here's the Ellipsis device, which we have used in our practice. It's a single venous access catheter placed through a superficial vein into the deep communicating vein. The jaws are opened, and you can see in the lower right-hand image a animal model of an actual anastomosis where you have fused pressure and heat to create a secure anastomosis. An image on the left lower from Dr. Hull of the from the pivotal study showing the an actual fistulogram done of the proximal radial artery fistula created by the Ellipsis system. Next slide. So here's a schematic image showing the needle has been introduced with ultrasound imaging only through the superficial system into the deep communicating system. The needle's advanced to the back wall of the deep communicating vein where it is adjacent to the radial artery. The needle goes into the radial artery, followed by a guide wire. Next slide. The device is then advanced over the guide wire. The jaws are closed. A few seconds of the delivery of the energy from the device creates the anastomosis. In the original pivotal study, these patients were returned after a week for follow-up and generally most often had a angioplasty of this anastomosis to complete the maturation. This has long ago been replaced by an immediate balloon maturation at the time of the procedure that's just an integral part of the procedure now, so that secondary balloon is not necessary unless some stenosis develops. Next slide. So the initial studies, Dr. Hull and others, it was five centers. As I recall, it was four interventional nephrologists and one interventional radiologist, about 100 patients, and you can see from the results the cumulative patency at the termination of the study was close to 90%, and functional patency was very good. Dr. Malios trained here with us and then now is in Paris, and is his initial study of these ellipsis devices showed great technical success and long-term patency. Flow rates are about 900 milliliters per minute overall. He encountered no complications such as steel or arm edema, and patency rates were great. He noted and continues to notice fewer needs for superficialization or lipectomy in these individuals because of the territory saved by avoiding a surgical incision. Next slide. Longer follow-up is important, and this first reference is by Dr. Bethard and myself and Terry Litchfield looking at maturation of the original pivotal study group. They were all able to be followed. You can see from the, I don't need to read all that back to you, but the duration of the fistula with cumulative patency of almost 93% at 2 years was outstanding. Ms. Litchfield did a post-procedure evaluation emphasizing a really as expected, high level of patient satisfaction with these outcomes. Dr. Malios has now approached 300 patients, and his review recently of 234 individuals. Once again, technical success was 99% with much longer follow-up. Flow values were about 900 milliliters per minute on average. Zero significant adverse events related to the procedure. Very few patients required later conversion to a surgical fistula, and a fewer percentage of patients required superficialization, I think an important concept with a percutaneous fistula. You'll also note an average maturation time, only 4 weeks. Next slide. I thought these images were interesting. The one on the right is the cover of the Journal of Vascular Surgery recently showing a ellipsis percutaneous fistula. This happens to be a patient that had a high bifurcation of the radial artery, and this was a well-functioning fistula with a lovely image suitable for a cover picture. The images on the left, Dr. Malios, so this is not a published case, but it was interesting. A patient with increasing peripheral vascular disease and slowly lower flow in the ellipsis proximal radial artery fistula that he planned to do inflow proximalization. So he dissected out the fistula, and you can see it is simply a fistula that looks like any other surgical fistula that we have ever made. There's nothing peculiar or unusual about it. It's revisable and functional just like a regular fistula. This one was treated with an inflow proximalization to avoid the risk of steal with distal disease progressive downstream. I also listed a couple of papers, early cannulation. We reviewed a series of patients with ellipsis fistulas that had early cannulation defined by 1 to 14 days. 13 to 14 were successful without complication, suggesting that this may play a role in avoiding prolonged maturation problems. These were all patients that had problematic catheters, and early cannulation was used with the plastic needles available in Europe to avoid a new catheter placement. And the number two reference was a recently published series of four patients that had deep communicating veins of adequate size at the wrist, and the ellipsis device was used to create a percutaneous classic Cimino radiocephalic fistula. Next slide. So this kind of parallels Dr. Wassey's comments about the long and winding road to a functional fistula, time for referrals. A lot of surgeons don't do their own vessel mapping. Our group does, and we think that saves a lot of time. And then time to surgery, busy schedules and delays there, postoperative time for follow-up and maturation. So as we open up the opportunity for access creation to many other doctors, but I would suggest including surgeons in this use of this device, we're going to save a dramatic amount of catheter time. Interventions are required, more time. And again, just like Dr. Wassey mentioned, there's a large variation among surgeons in their success rate and long-term patency. And you're going to bump into some patients that say, I'm simply not going to have a surgical operation, but are willing to consider a percutaneous procedure. Next slide.
And, Doctor, we are down to 1 minute.
Okay.
This just characterizes
why percutaneous fistulas may be better. You're going to have fewer technical misadventures, less opportunity for a rotation or a twisting of the vein. Proximal radial artery fistulas, just whether they're surgical or ellipsis, are going to have lower pressures and lower flow versus brachial access, and therefore less risks of stenosis and aneurysms. You're going to have fewer fistulas that are lost from steel or cardiac high flow issues. Cannulation zones extended, that's a very real outcome from percutaneous fistulas. And then I mentioned the cannulation that may be earlier. And lastly, a radiocephalic fistula is not precluded. If vessel dimensions change or improve because of bidirectional flow, that doesn't mean you couldn't do a radiocephalic fistula later. Next slide. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
Dr. Jennings, thank you very much. A couple questions or comments. You've been a big proponent of the proximal radial artery AV fistula surgically created. It's been somewhat overlooked in the past. Are you now out of the surgical proximal radial artery AV fistula business?
No, I couldn't list all the studies that have been done, but we've also done some studies looking at how many of these patients are going to be candidates for a percutaneous fistula, and it's maybe 60%, it may be more or less depending on your patient population, so there's still going to be a role. You're going to have patients that don't have a good deep communicating vein. You're going to have patients that don't have an easy access, and some providers may not adopt percutaneous fistulas right away or at all. So there's going to always be a role for that. I emphasize the benefit of either proximal radial or proximal ulnar access in avoiding so many complications associated with high-flow brachial artery fistulas. So there's going to be always a need for a surgical approach in a very real number of patients. But, yes, I think this is probably going to replace a lot of the surgical cases.
I know your focus has been mostly on the ellipsis system, or I think so anyway. Have you had any experience with the wavelength system?
My own, I have no personal experience. I helped Robert Shevardian, the surgeon in Hamburg, with his paper that has just recently been accepted, and it compares the two devices. So I think that will come out, and there is there was a difference in cumulative patency at the end of follow-up, and there was a difference favoring ellipsis also in the number of adverse events. So, again, I'm biased, and I've had experience physically only with the ellipsis device. So, for what it's worth.
So, going back to your prior comment, if you had those 40% that may not be a candidate for ellipsis, would you consider a wavelength approach before an open surgical approach in at least some of them, or not?
They would not be a candidate for ellipsis because the deep communicating vein is either too far away
right.
or inadequate. So it might be possible that a wavelength would be appropriate. In that paper I just mentioned that's now coming out and available, the majority of patients were something like 70% were candidates for an ellipsis fistula, but only 20 or 30% candidates anatomically by ultrasound examination for the wavelength. So you're right, there will be occasional patients that are appropriate for a wavelength and not ellipsis, but on the other hand, the most are going to be candidates for ellipsis.
So if you did have a patient that was not a candidate for ellipsis, would you now, as of today, pursue the wavelength before you did an open surgical approach or not?
I would not. I would do a surgical, a surgical proximal radial artery fistula is not a huge operation, so it's a pretty minimal operation, but I would do that before the wavelength due to the adverse events that have been reported with the other device.
Dr. Jennings, thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Our next registered speaker is Dr. Henschel. Operator, if you could open his line.
Hello, this is Dirk Henschel. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this panel. I am Director of Interventional Nephrology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and I'm also on the board of VASA, Vascular Access Society of the Americas, as well as ASDIN. Next slide, please. My disclosures are listed here. I work with a variety of companies as the dialysis access space until relatively recently has seen a paucity of innovation, and a lot of innovation comes from industry, and so I've worked with a lot of companies on different aspects. Next slide, please. As Dr. Wasse and Dr. Jennings expounded on, the dialysis access space, I think, is characterized by a huge variation in maturation success that varies widely. Some centers and physicians have 80% success, others less than 20%. We also know that different types of accesses, forearm cephalic versus upper arm and cephalic and upper arm transposed basilic veins, have different failure modes. And if you think of patients that are on dialysis with a catheter versus patients that are still in the pre-SRD phase, it often is very important to take into account the time until they may use the access and what complications they may experience in that interim. That may be pulmonary hypertension due to longstanding high access flows, repeated angioplasties from stenosis, thrombosis, all violent access may not even be used. There also is uncertainty with progression of ESRD. So having dialysis access types that are relatively complication-free, in particularly for the pre-SRD period, which is where, as a system, we're trying to create accesses so that patients don't crash into dialysis with the need for a tunneled catheter. What are the options there? So locally, we have made a very conscious decision to kind of push radial artery wrist near-based accesses as they have the lowest flow and the lowest complication number in the long term, and they can often just sit there and mature. But we have recently also found that endovascularly created arteriovenous fistulas maintain relatively low flows and can also sit there in a pre-SRD fashion, mature arterial inflow as well as venous outflow options with, to date, few observed complications. So next slide, please. You saw this slide before, so we can move on. So this is just the ellipsis device. This is the device that we currently at our hospital are certified to use. We are working on having the WaveLink device also approved, and I'll talk a little bit more about why we want both devices later on. Next slide, please. So this is just a general timeline of how accesses are created at our center. You've heard before that the timelines can be very, very long, and we have a very active collaboration with our vascular surgeons so that we really rapidly transition patients through. But I also show this to show that there's a lot that goes into access creation beyond the procedure. So there's ultrasound evaluation, or in our case, we do a lot of vein mapping, venography. We put into context the anatomy that we discuss as a team. Is a wrist access possible? Is there a mid-forearm option? Is there an unusual forearm vein option, something using the basilic? Jennings fistula that we sometimes create, we take into account the patient's comorbidities. Can they actually have, do we really want to push a forearm fistula with relatively lower flow in somebody with heart failure? Are there known central vein occlusions that also would push us to create really a low flow access? Then obviously the life expectancy. As you heard from Dr. Wasse, most autogenous accesses require some kind of additional procedure, and Dr. Jennings has talked about the epitome of obesity in many parts of the U.S. where the upper arm access that now makes up, by and large, over 75% of accesses in the United States, they almost universally need some kind of superficialization or lipectomy to really offer a great distance for usability. And so in our ranking, we really start at the wrist with a snuffbox or Cimino and then work our way up and would view endo-AVF procedures kind of in between the wrist and the proximal radial artery to cephalic vein options, either standard Cimino, standard upper arm cephalic vein access or Jennings-type access. Next slide, please. Here, as an example, the criteria for endovascular access creation using the ellipsis. So these are the ultrasound criteria. As was alluded to, the theoretical suitability for ellipsis-type accesses is about two-thirds of patients. The WaveLink studies, the newer one that Dr. Jennings referred to has slightly lower in the hands of Rob Shavardian in Germany, but other studies also show kind of a 60% suitability in theory. While in our local clinical setting with a very concerted team effort and an absolute kind of focus on wrist-based accesses, we end up with about 10% of patients that go into the procedure room with a potential for endo-AVF candidacy, but then after regional or general anesthesia, we find that there are still several patients that show their veins at the wrist, and we then have the surgical creation of a wrist fistula rather than the endo-AVF in mid-arm. Even though we aggressively pursue wrist fistulas, I think 75% of our fistulas now newly created are wrist-based radial artery fistulas. We still have maturation successes that are kind of around 90%. So for us, the question what type of access we create, since they all give us about a maturation in the high 80s or 90% range, is really what is the best anatomy to support this patient? How does it best fit into the patient's morbidity, mortality, and life plan? Next slide, please. So the next seven slides is really a rundown through the Ellipsis technology. That's the one that we currently have access to in the hospital. And this is just to kind of bring home the realization that there is actually a skill involved in guiding the needle through the vessels. So in the studies, you've seen the data that the time for the procedure is between 7 and 35 minutes if Dr. Malios does this, who does it relatively frequently, with an average of 15 minutes. But not every operator who's capable of creating surgical fistulas or who's able to wield dialysis angioplasty balloons necessarily has the skill set ready-made to do this. So there's a learning curve. Some people may never be completely comfortable with this. Similarly, if you look at the wavelink technique that I think Dr. Berland will speak to as a final speaker today, also that is a technology that requires a different skill set that not every operator has. There are surgeons that create access these surgically that don't have endovascular training. It may be general surgeons or it may be transplant surgeons that don't have that training. And so it's often provider-driven which technology which approach is the one that gets you to successful access creation. So we can just run through the next slide here. You plan the anastomosis, you measure, make sure that the distances are okay, that where you can cannulate the vein. Next slide, please. You advance under ultrasound guidance. Next slide. And then place a sheath. Next slide. And then, the wire. Next slide. Deploy the device, and we can go next slide. You see here the actual fusing of the vessels. Then use a balloon to post-dilate. Next slide. And then
We are down to 1 minute, please.
Yeah, fistula created. Yeah, and so next slide, please. And so this is actually my last slide. Local systems of availability of expertise determine often what kind of access is created. And we don't have real, true long-term outcomes. In the dialysis access space, I would say that's 5 or 10 years or more, to see what are the long-term consequences of creating a fistula by endovascular means. And so in my mind, the two available technologies are relatively equivalent in terms of uncertainty how the long-term works. Clearly, they both successfully can create accesses. I think the fact that the wavelink device is now in its third evolution of a technology shows also that there is a lot of development still in this space. There's responsiveness to things that are being observed that I think over time will affect suitability and safety. And you heard that now even a direct wrist-based radial cephalic vein fistula has been created using the Ellipsis device. So there is still a lot of movement in this space, and it would be fantastic to allow this variety, as there are many other new technologies in this space. As you can see here, humacyte, human cell-derived vessels, biografts that are used as early cannulation things, other early cannulation catheters, novel tunneled catheters. Thank you very much, last slide, for allowing me to share our experience here.
Dr. Henschel, thank you for your comment. Some similar questions that I had for Dr. Jennings. Do you personally have any experience with the wavelength system?
So our hospital took about 6 months to to 9 months to let us use the Ellipsis device, and which we have now used, and we're in the process of getting the Wavelink device approved for use. But I don't have any Wavelink experience, but in my daily life, I use wires every day, and so I feel that's kind of a lovely, comfortable transition to go to that. It's much more free-floating to do an ultrasound-guided fistula creation.
Ultrasound, which is the Ellipsis, not the Wavelink.
Yes, correct. I mean, it's more of a, for somebody who works a lot wire and catheter-based, the Wavelink seems intuitively safer because you kind of know where you are. While if you go through three-dimensional space under ultrasound guidance, that's kind of a, you know, we do that a lot by getting central venous access for tunnel dialysis catheters. But in this case, going from one vessel into another vessel, that's kind of the jump that I had to learn. But it can be learned very quickly if you have a basic set of skills there. But I know that a lot of providers that are very experienced with guide wires and with catheters, they feel an intuitive transition into the Wavelink device. So I have not worked with it, so I don't have any personal experience with it.
Dr. Henschel, thank you for your comments.
Yep.
Our next registered speaker is Dr. Berland. Operator, if you could open his line, thanks.
Hello. Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Great. Hey, guys. I'm Dr. Todd Berland. I'm a vascular surgeon based out of New York. I've been creating these fistulas for about 5 years. I was the first vascular surgeon to use this latest generation or this 4-French generation device to create a fistula, and this was several years ago. Next slide, please. For disclosures, I have no conflicts of interest. I don't hold any equity in either company. I have no stock. I have nothing financially to gain by any decision that is made. I am a Medicare provider and practice within this NGS jurisdiction. I am a consultant for BD and presenting for them, but really on behalf of my practice and my experience. And my last disclosure is I'm also a Sirius XM radio host. Dr. Radio is a direct to patient. You guys may have heard it in your car going to and from work when you're not on lockdown, but it is an opportunity where we have a 2-hour show dedicated to vascular surgery. Patients can call in, and a number of times we've talked about this technology and the excitement and the interest in patients and from the patient advocacy groups is pretty significant. Next slide, please. I will go over an overview of surgical fistulas. It's been talked about already. I'll discuss Wavelink and then some of the concerns with the proposed LCD changes. Next slide. Now, this is a slide really kind of setting the stage. We've heard from the previous presenters that surgical fistulas, which are the standard of care, are also fraught with their own issues. You can see on the y-axis there AV fistulas, AV grafts, and central venous catheters. The mortality rates, although favorable for AV fistulas, are real in this patient group. And if you look at infection rates, 2% for AV fistulas and then 13 and 18 for the grafts and catheters, still better for fistulas, but this is a real problem. Moving on to the primary patency in the last column, again, favoring AV fistulas. This is our gold standard. This is what we're trying to compare endo-AVF, both Ellipsis and Wavelink to. So this is really the unmet need here. The fact that surgical fistulas are not, despite being done since the 1960s, there's not been a lot of evolution and innovation in this space. Next slide, please. We need an alternative to surgical fistulas. Only about 1 in 5 patients initiate dialysis with a fistula. Failure rates are high. It can take months to mature. And then this last point is really my favorite point. When I'm talking to patients about surgical fistulas, and to date, I still create more surgical fistulas than I do endo-AVFs. I'm a big fan of endo-AVF. It does have a role in lots of patients. But when I'm talking about patients, I am talking about surgical fistulas needing, on average, 2 to 3 reinterventions per year to keep those fistulas open. The body just tries to shut those down. So we're constantly trying to balloon angioplasty and open these fistulas. And these high failure rates and long maturation times really have prompted some innovation. Next slide. So if you look at the surgical fistula that hasn't really evolved in half a century, the cephalic vein is transected, the other end is oversewn, and we swing that vein over onto the artery, we make an incision, we use a scalpel to open up that artery and manually sew the vessel on. This, we think, may be causing some of the issues that we are seeing longer term that were not really seen with ellipsis and wavelength devices. Essentially, what we have is a traumatic fistula creation, for lack of better words. When I asked the inventor of wavelength how he came up with this idea, it was really quite ingenious. He was a surgical resident and noticed that trauma patients who were shot or stabbed, when that bullet or knife nicked an artery or vein, those patients would develop AV fistulas. And when he followed these patients up in the office, these fistulas would never close. Contrast that to surgical fistulas that you're constantly battling with reinterventions to keep them open for the life of that fistula. The traumatic fistulas just didn't seem to close down. So what wavelength and really to a degree ellipsis does is it's almost akin to a traumatic fistula where we are creating energy and going through an artery or vein either in the radial or ulnar positions to create this fistula in the deep veins to get flow superficially into the upper arm veins for dialysis. So whereas the ellipsis has the option for a radial fistula creation, wavelength is similar to that but also adds the ulnar option as well. Next slide. Sorry. Can you guys see these slides?
Yes, we can.
I'm sorry, my screen just went off here. Oh, there it is. Okay, I've got the six French device on my screen. I hope you guys can see that. Well, this device is the one that really paved the way for the innovation. This was the first generation device. It's been discontinued. A lot of the data that we're looking at evolves around this six French device. It involved a brachial artery access, but this did really pave the way for an endovascular fistula. Next slide, please. The second generation device, which we've been using since last year, is much smaller, 50% smaller. It's a four French device, much smaller hole in the artery. So as a vascular surgeon, I've been taught to really appreciate and respect the brachial artery. It's usually a very thin-walled artery. Any pseudoaneurysm or bleeding is fraught with lots of trouble. Patients can have lots of problems with hematomas, pseudoaneurysms from brachial artery bleeding. So we really like this idea of a smaller, more streamlined catheter with a four French device. And while we're talking about the device, we have two catheters. One goes inside the artery, one inside the vein. Magnets pull them together. And then once we confirm under fluoroscopy that everything looks good, that the fistula creation will be in the location that we want, we hook the back end of the catheter up to a RF generator off the field, we press the button, and we burn a hole from the venous side into the arterial side. So we create a traumatic fistula, and we create a fistula between the artery and vein in that deep system. Next slide, please. So really what we have here is two catheters in the vessels. We create about a 5 by 2 millimeter hole, which is similar to a surgical anastomosis when we actually physically sew an artery to a vein, and we get communication or flow from the artery into the venous side. Next slide. So looking at the studies to date, really what we have is the FLEX study and the NEAT study, which were the six French devices. I'm the first author and primary author of the EASE study, where we were going down to Paraguay and really performing these procedures on patients. There was four of us that did these studies. They were each of our first patients, so I think I contributed about 10 of the patients. These were my first 10 procedures ever created. Contrast that to surgical fistula papers where some of the operators have done hundreds, if not thousands, of these before, you know, enrolling or studying these. These were literally, the four of us who had done these had never done one before, and this first study was capturing that experience. So early in the learning curve type of experience. And we had very good safety and efficacy rates there with good maturation rates. Moving forward to the EASE-2 and post-market studies, again, this is now just recently completed and being looked at, and now the post-market study will be starting soon. Again, looking at the four French device. 6 French device has now been discontinued. All of our efforts are for French, 50% smaller device. Next slide, please. There's also a paper that was recently published, Journal of Vascular Access, by Dr. Instin. Again, his first 30 patients, so early again on the learning curve, compared to 40 surgical fistulas. Again, he's been doing this for 20 years, so he's done hundreds of surgical fistulas, but just started a prospective study looking at 30 versus 40, and you can see the numbers there. I don't want to read them all out, but you can see that the procedural success, the primary patency, all very favorable for wavelength. Mean patency was excellent, and that was statistically significant when compared to surgical fistulas, with reasonable secondary patency as well. So really, to date, in these studies, we have about 214 studied patients, including this 30 from Instin, with very good data. We've got about 300 physicians that have been trained in our country to do this procedure over the last year, and I'm involved with some of this physician training, but 100 of them are from this area that we're talking in this NGS jurisdiction. These 100 physicians will be affected by this. Next slide, please. Really, what's interesting here is that the FDA and CMS have both supported EndoAVF with WaveLink and Ellipsis really from the get-go. They cleared both in June of 2018. They gave them both C codes in 2019. And in 1 week from today, there'll be now a G code, again, for both WaveLink and Ellipsis, establishing payment for physicians. And in a rare move, CMS increased payment for 2020. For both of these technologies as well. So really, these two technologies have been lockstep the entire way. Next slide. The MAUDE database. So this is really one of the issues with the LCG projection, that we know that the FDA concedes that MAUDE data has limitations. The data is incomplete, it's inaccurate, it's biased, and the FDA even warns that MAUDE data should not be used to evaluate adverse events. We don't have a denominator, it's hard to compare rates across events, and when you look at a big company like BD that acquired a company, Bard, that acquired TVA Medical, the small device company that first had the WaveLink device, you've got a big company that has a big regulatory and compliance department who is really going to try and report every little thing. If you look at the MAUDE database, the 70 or so entries in there, the majority are from BD employees. And still, the majority of cases had a successful fistula created, even though there may have been some type of event. And really, at the end of the day, there have been no limb-threatening or life-threatening events from either of these devices. So really, what we are saying is that the MAUDE database has significant limitations and really should not be used to make a decision, especially a comparative decision between devices. Next slide, please.
And, Doctor, we are down to 1 minute, please.
Okay, great. Now, looking at really focus on that bottom line for one moment here, looking at all of these studies, again, this is pooling all the data, 4 French and 6 French, technical success rate high, similar to what you see with Ellipsis, device-related SAEs, 2.2%, again, similar to what the retrospective Ellipsis study would show, and then procedural-related SAEs, I think, inappropriately higher secondary to those initial 6 French device studies. We had brachial artery hematomas, and then people tried to get smart and use closure devices. The closure devices themselves in the brachial artery are an off-label procedure. Physicians were using those and not having very good results. So we have the highest complication in that initial NEAT study, which was that 6 French device. Again, no longer available. Next slide. Looking at the studies to date, again, similar age, if you look at patency, very similar at 6 and 12 months, and then median or mean time to needle cannulation. Again, similar in these days. This is a metric that's hard to follow because in a pre-dialysis patient, you may not be cannulating them if they don't yet need to be on dialysis. They may have a fistula that's ready to go, but they don't need dialysis, so hard to look at that number. Next slide. So really, in conclusion here, this is my last slide. Both technologies have comparable safety and clinical profiles. Lots of procedures have been done to date. This is a field that has had very little to no innovation, and to try and stop this now would be like pulling the plug and pulling the energy out of a grassroots movement here where patients are finally having an option or something else. Instead of a surgical fistula being thrown upon them, they are finally now having an option that is not a surgical procedure. And neither of these procedures burn any bridges. We're creating fistulas between that radial artery and radial vein, or ulnar artery and ulnar vein, and not obviating any kind of future access issues. This is simply giving another option and another space to create a fistula in a very difficult patient population. And finally, I'll just end with that relying on the MAUDE database is really contradicting the FDA's warning to not rely on this to compare devices because of all those inherent inaccuracies. So really limiting the access to just ellipsis or just wavelength or to both would really hurt patients' ability to provide alternative access care to their patients. Just like Dr. Henschel was saying, these procedures complement each other. Not everybody's anatomy is conducive to one or the other, and not every operator is familiar or as easily able to perform one procedure or the other. So these are very complementary procedures that are both adding another option for patients. And that's all I have.
Dr. Berlin, thank you. as is noted in the LCD, I mean, there's two, the basis for the non-coverage at the moment was the shorter follow-up. We don't have, we have two-year follow-up on ellipsis. And only one-year follow-up, and actually, if you talk about the fourth branch, it's even more limited than that, really, in any large numbers anyway. But the other issue is, and you mentioned this, the MAUDE, or the Manufacturer and User Facility Device Experience Database, which, as you mentioned, actually, as of yesterday, there were 75 reported issues for wavelength. And zero for ellipsis. Now, that's hard to ignore, as you can probably imagine. The not all of the issues, the 75 issues, and I should say that in the last year, most of them are related to the 4 French, not the legacy 6 French. Various problems with the device, like failure to align, failure to cut, material deformation. Maybe not all of those led to a complication. Maybe some of them went on to a successful procedure, but they at least they had those issues.
Well, can I comment?
Are you suggesting that the ellipsis, that there are a similar number of ellipsis issues, but they're just not being reported?
Well, I wouldn't dare say there's a similar number because you have to look at the denominator. I think the CMS SAF database demonstrates that more wavelength procedures are being done than ellipsis, so I would not expect that numerator, that 75, to be similar with ellipsis.
Okay, percent-wise, it's not absolute number.
But if you look retrospectively at the data, they both have between a 2 and 3% SAE rate. So I do think that they're inherently similar from that standpoint, but I do think if you look at Ellipsis or Avenue Medical as a company compared to TVA, which was a small company that got bought by a bigger company, that got bought by an even bigger company that has this over-regulatory want a need for compliance, you're going to have some inherent over-reporting in that bigger company, and I think that's what we're seeing here. And again, I have nothing to disclose. I don't have anything to gain from your decision with this, but you can easily see that a bigger company is liable to over-report this. So if you look at this data, I think you really need to look at the published data where both of these devices are very similar. And more for your first question, when you really look at the Ellipsis study, that's a retrospective study, and it really doesn't involve their newest iteration where they are doing that secondary procedure as part of the first, which I think is a great move on their part to kind of condense it and move things forward. I don't know that 2-year data even includes that type of procedure or that evolution of procedure. The wavelength data is all prospective studies that have moved out, and again, we got 6 and 12 month data, which in most spaces in the device world is sufficient for coverage and FDA approval, et cetera.
Well, on the other hand, one of our prior speakers said that they prefer 5 to 10 year, and said from that standpoint, 1 or 2 years is relatively the same. But
right. And you will get there, I think. But when you rip out reimbursement and coverage, then physicians won't be able to do that, and we will never have those studies. But it would be great. It took 15 years, 20 years before aneurysms had a study comparing EVAR to open surgery. You really have to have it available, have the technology out there, and the option for physicians to use it to then get this data.
Yeah. I wonder if, Operator, if you could just open up the lines on our prior three, Dr. Wasse, Dr. Jennings, and Dr. Henschel, if you have, if any of them have any comments on this MAUDE issue, because that, frankly, is a large impediment that we're seeing, and I'd appreciate if they had any insights into how much we should or shouldn't value that.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennings. Can you hear me?
Yes, Dr. Jennings.
So in the new study from Germany, Dr. Shabardian, the adverse events, including a brachial artery bleed that required stenting and those things were, I think, in his experience, four for wavelength and one for ellipsis. I also would want to comment on the question of long-term data on the immediate balloon maturation in the ellipsis. Dr. Malios's series that was 240 cases, only the very first few, like the first 20, were with bringing them back for an angioplasty. So 95% of those were done with, or at least 90% of those were done with immediate balloon maturation. So that does have the long-term, or at least the midterm data available.
And as far as the MAUDE database, how much should we credit that?
Well, I think that whether you look at the original study with Wavelink or not, but there's just not a lot of published data about the Wavelink, and those are real things. They are brachial artery injuries or failure to complete the procedure, those kind of things. So, and I think Dr. Berlin's able to talk to those, as he already has, better than I because of his experience with Wavelink. But some of them are real.
And do you feel, since you're somewhat affiliated with the Ellipsis company, do you feel that there's potential for underreporting because of the company smaller than BD?
I don't know of that. I don't know anything.
Okay.
I don't have knowledge of that.
Okay. Dr. Wasse or Dr. Henschel, do you have any comments on the MAUDE database and how much that should be weighted in general or ignored?
This is Monty Wasse. I think that's a difficult question. I mean, we all are aware of at our institutions and out in the community of some of the misfiring and some of the issues. Dr. Berlin brings up a point of saying that it's more likely that things are getting reported because there are more number of users with Wavelink. But I don't know that's necessarily the point that I would make. I think that this is a different skill set that's used for each one of these devices, and different anatomy is required, and ensuring that the patients are being selected appropriately and have anatomy that actually fits with the devices are really key issues here. So, and I think maybe it's just because there's some care that's clearly practitioners are taking care in terms of selecting patients, but because they're dual sheaths and ensuring that there's a proximity with the two vessels with one another, and avoiding calcifications and things like that might contribute to misfiring. Maybe those are issues that are arising that might be contributing to some of the complexities.
So, in other words, you think the database is the reporting is somewhat real. It's not to be discounded altogether.
Well, I would say that simply on the basis of seeing what's happened at my own institution, being aware of what's happened at other institutions with the devices. But again, I'm less about comparing this as being apples and oranges, and more about just saying that these employ different vascular anatomy and require different skill sets that need to be optimized to ensure that complications are avoided.
Thank you. Dr. Berlin, I know you're about to talk, but let me just get Dr. Henschel in here. Do you have anything to add, Dr. Henschel?
I think that the point that Dr. Wasse was making about skill sets and anatomy, I think that's kind of what I would also focus on. And I just want to put this into the greater context. So, for instance, we use PTFE grafts as an alternative to fistulas. And they have infection rates that, are in the 10 to 10%. That's kind of accepted in the first year. and we still use them, right? And so I think one of the things here is disclosure, right? So if you talk to a patient, I think the disclosure that there is a, there's this risk of vascular complication, but there's the benefit of having a fistula created in a specific location in a way that otherwise doesn't have surgery, I think that's something that should go into this process, right? And I appreciate that the company is working on updated technology to reduce the rate of complications, but the MOT database is what it is, right? I mean, you can't discuss, you can't really argue away that people are reporting things, and we may at some point see more reports for the ellipsis technology if that is more widely used, you know, we don't know if it's speculative at this point.
Thank you. Dr. Berlin, I wasn't sure, were you trying to get in some last words?
No, I mean, I would just say that, you know, from all the biases that go into the self-reporting, I think we just have to be careful. And I just want to reiterate that the majority of those reports were from BD employees, and the majority of patients still had a successful fistula created. I think there were only six reported patient injuries. So we're talking very few with, you know, 3,000 devices sold already across the country. So I think these numbers are very small, relatively speaking. And I think that the MAUD database shouldn't be used, and that when the committee makes their decision, they should really look at the published data, and particularly the newer, safer four French devices that make smaller holes in the access arteries.
Thank you, Dr. Berlin, for your comments. Operator, if we could ask if there are any other comments on this policy at this point.
Absolutely. As a reminder, if you have a comment or a question, please press star 1. You'll be prompted to record your name. Once again, if you have a comment or a question, please press star 1. It'll take just a moment for those to come through. Once again, if you have a comment or a question, please press. It looks like we have nothing coming through at this time.
Thank you, Operator. Open meeting comments on this policy will now be closed. The next policy for comment is, again, a current policy that we've made some revisions to. It's percutaneous vertebral augmentation for osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture. There were two changes made. In addition to acute 0 to 6 week fractures, subacute fractures 6 to 12 weeks were added to the inclusion criteria. Also, the multidisciplinary referral segment was clarified along with the education requirements, with more of an emphasis on ensuring the continuum of care and preventing medical undertreatment of the overarching systemic disease, osteoporosis, of which VCF is a symptom. So the two requirements here are all patients presenting with VCF should be referred for evaluation of bone mineral density and osteoporosis education for subsequent treatment as indicated, and all patients with VCF should be instructed to take part in an osteoporosis prevention treatment program. These changes were made on the basis of concerns about real-world barriers to both multidisciplinary referral and time to surgery. We have three registered presenters today. The first is Dr. Levy. Operator, if you could open his line.
Hello, am I here?
Dr. Levy, we can hear you, yes.
Yes. There was a request for Dr. Beal to go first. I believe he has another meeting. If that's not okay, then I'll go. But if it's okay, then can we defer to
him? That's fine. That's okay with me. I hadn't seen that request. So, Dr. Beal?
I'll go after him.
Sure. Operator, if you could open Dr. Beal's line.
President Kanapur.
And before we, operator, if we could move ahead to Dr. Beal's slides. We only have his conflict of interest slides. Oh, I think you're already there. Thanks. Good.
Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Peel.
Thank you very much, Dr. Howe. Let's go on to the next slide. I'm Doug Beal, an interventional radiologist. Next slide. I'm author of, next slide, please. Just go ahead and click through all the disclosure slides, if you would. I'm the primary author of the Comprehensive Guide for Vertebral Augmentation. I've been doing vertebral augmentation, treating patients for underlying osteoporosis and dealing with vertebral fractures since the early 90s. As we're looking for my slides, I'll just go ahead and start. First of all, I'd like to say the changes have been optimal. I like the changes to the LCD. These have been very much well needed, and I'm glad the changes have been made. I'm going to deal with an issue on timeline, and if we can find my slides and click down to slide number 9, that would be good. As was mentioned,
Dr. Beal, as I told you, your slides didn't make it in time to be on the deck.
But I had the original slides submitted previously for the presentation before the last LCD.
Right. Well, those okay. were before the new LCD was published. So they didn't.
That's not what was communicated to me. But let me continue. All right. So the issue about adding acute fractures is fine. Acute fractures have a good amount of information. Subacute fractures have more information, and the issues with chronic fractures have about the same amount of as acute fractures, but these were excluded from the LCD. So there's in the Comprehensive Guide to Vertebral Augmentation, we wrote a whole book chapter about it. It has 24 references, and I will submit all my slides with all the supporting data of this. It also has a presented but as of yet unpublished new sham trial called Virtus 5. Virtus 4 was submitted as the LCD in terms of the supporting information and is all over the document for the supporting information. This is Virtus 5, and this is the treatment of chronic fractures that has been previously presented and has concluded vertebroplasty is safe and effective for the treatment of chronic fractures with a statistically significant improvement in pain and quality of life. So the question really is if there's the same amount of data supporting chronic fracture treatment for painful vertebral compression fractures as acute fracture treatment, why is this not being allowed? Moving on to the next topic, the infiltration for periosteal infiltration, the option to do that prior to treatment. As I mentioned previously, this is completely unsupported by literature at all. In the all five sham trials, none of them had infiltration of the pedicle with anesthetic is an option for treatment. Zero. One had docking the pedicles in the outside of the needles in the outside of the pedicles. The other one had infiltration of skin and subcutaneous tissue. The other one had infiltration over the lamina, but none of them had infiltration around the pedicle used in isolation. And the trials by Wilson, M, and Wang had infiltration of the facet joint, not the pedicle. So recommendation to do this came through the evidence that referenced in the seventh paragraph, the opinions in Virtus 4. This was a Firinescu article. I contacted these authors and confirmed that this is just author opinion. And the senior author whom I spoke to, Dr. Paul Lally, confirmed that. And author opinion is nothing more than just unsubstantiated evidence that should not provide as a surrogate for evidence-based medicine and evidence-based information. Also, the fracture levels are also arbitrarily limited from T5 to L5, and there's no reason for this limitation. Again, we wrote a whole book chapter about treatment of fractures beyond this limit, and this has 42 references. This also involves people that are very sick and ill, such as people with metastatic cancer, which I will touch on in a second, people with glucocorticoid-induced osteoporosis, and people with severe osteoporosis and multiple myeloma. So these are this is clearly an arbitrary distinction that we really should not do because there are plenty of evidence. In addition to the 42 references in the book chapter, there are 12 level 1 and level 2 data, And I had that on my slide, but I have all this information, including with PDFs, with articles, manuscripts for each one of these 12 articles that involve treatment beyond the levels of T5 to L5. And finally, for the exclusion criteria, the exclusion criteria is listed as no more than 3 fractures. And it's my understanding that this was a misunderstanding, that this was meant to be no more than 3 fractures at a time. But at least one of the medical directors that I've spoken with has said that his opinion was that this was limited to 3 fractures in a lifetime. So that's a very big discrepancy in this. And not only that would be like treating somebody's one hip fracture and not treating the second broken hip in somebody's lifetime. Also, that's not a contraindication at all. UCLA RAND methodology for appropriateness criteria methodology does not list treating more than 3 fractures at all in either absolute strong, usually contraindicated, or relative contraindications. So this should not be listed at all. This is a relative safety limitation, but if this is limited, if you do limit this more than 3 fractures, as I mentioned, there's data with multiple myeloma, data with glucocorticoid-induced osteoporosis. There's one level 1 trial that had an average of 3.36 patients enrolled, and there's credible cancer data, most recently by an author named Moulin that presented this as for publication this year, was out. So I'm going to summarize it up. So there's extensive data that supports treating patients from outside the limitation of T5 to L5. And this limitation is arbitrary and should not be kept. This is something that will limit people, probably the most vulnerable to the patient population that have fractures outside this area, most commonly from T1 to T4. Periosteal infiltration should be removed, even as a recommendation. This is unsubstantiated opinion, and this is not replicated in any of the level 1 trials nor in any of the posterior element trials. Treatment of chronic fractures has the same evidence as treatment of acute fractures with now the new sham trial. So this really should be considered for patients with painful chronic fractures, because what else are you going to do? They're not candidates for screws and rods. If they have persistent severe pain, then this should be allowed. And then treating more than 3 fractures is a limitation. That is a bad idea. That will limit arbitrarily and inadvertently the most severely affected patients from treatment. And finally, almost as a parenthetic comment, but I want to make this as a distinct point, there's no cancer codes in here. So the treatment of patients with a cancer diagnosis, and that's 100,000 fractures a year, I'm just going to assume that that's an oversight, because there's good level 1 data on this for the treatment of neoplastic fractures. There's an extensive number of there's meta-analyses, there's level 1 data. We wrote a whole book chapter about this. So I'm going to assume that this is an oversight. With that, I will stop right there. Thank you very much.
Dr. Real, thank you for your comments. Just to go over a few of them, the cancers, that's out of the scope of the policy. So as I think I mentioned to you, that I pointed out in the billing and coding section, it addresses this and says that that's out of scope, and the coverage will remain available for medically necessary procedures for other conditions not included in this article, LCD. So that's, okay. That's that point. The T5, L5, and the 3 fracture limit, that basically mirrors the inclusion criteria of most of the main studies. My interpretation of the 3 fracture was always at the same time, not a lifetime limitation. So I think that's what was meant in the studies themselves, and that certainly was my interpretation of it. So I don't think that's going to be much of an issue there. I'm not sure about...
Well, that will be an issue. Other. I mean, there's significant literature on this. And just
well, I mean, if we, it's not an issue if we clarify that.
Well, that's, I mean, the limited to 3 fractures should not be a contraindication. That's a relative safety limitation.
Yeah.
It's going to limit glucocorticoid cancer patients and multiple myeloma and severe osteoporosis.
Right.
There's level 1 and level 2 data associated with this.
It seems there's 2 issues there. One was the potential misunderstanding of lifetime versus, you know, at the same time, and the other is whether it should be a relative or absolute contraindication. And, you know, that's something we can
agree. Agreed. Yes, there are two issues.
And as far as the T5, L5, again, that was in most of the inclusion criteria, in most of the studies, you mentioned it was arbitrary. I mean, there's hardly ever something that's completely arbitrary that goes into these studies. There's probably some reason for it. We may not agree with those reasons, or we may think that despite those reasons, it shouldn't apply to the real world beyond the study. But I think you are aware that that was included in most of these studies. Are you aware of a reason for having that limitation and not just saying T1 to L5?
Yes, tradition and inertia. For example, the largest kyphoplasty trial ever done is the Evolve trial. And I was the PI of the Evolve trial. We had a limitation of T5 to L5. Do you know why? Because we were asked to by the Noridian jurisdiction, ENF, because they wanted to test out their LCD. They wanted information to see within their LCD, did this work under their existing local coverage determination or not? And that's why it was limited to T5 and L5, because it was done specifically with their criteria, inclusion-exclusion criteria. We have a whole list of people that were denied based on fractures above T5.
Dr. Beal, there were several major studies, RCTs, Vapor, Vertos 2, the free trial, that predated, I think, that discussion that also had that limitation.
I understand, but there's also Ken, Reiser, Evans, Paris, Vogel, Comstock, Ferrer, Blasco. There's numerous ones that do not use that as an inclusion.
Okay. All I'm asking is why did some of them, do you think?
This tradition and inertia. I mean, mostly these are the most common fractures absolutely happen from T5 to L5. The most common are thoracolumbar junctions, T10 to L2, by far. Two-thirds are thoracolumbar junction fractures. But to limit it to T5, my advice is, as an expert, is that if you limit it to T5 and exclude from T1 to T4, you're going to be excluding the people that are severely affected. Glucocorticoid-induced osteoporosis, myeloma, severe osteoporosis, and cancer, and this will not be well. And there's a known incidence of fractures from T1 to T4, and I have information, can speak to that, can submit the data on this. And this is not unusual. I won't disagree with the fact that the most common limiter is T5 to L5, but this is primarily for conducting randomized control trials. But this is real world, though.
Unlike the three fracture limitation, which I think we would both agree had certain safety concerns associated with doing more than three at a time. In the case of the T5 to L5, you don't see any real substantive reason beyond tradition that was included in those trials.
No, I have firsthand experience. I mean, not only do I see no reasons, I know why that is. That's inertia and tradition, and that's the most commonly treated patients. And so whenever we developed these protocols back, I started doing this in the early 90s, and so this just kind of came out and repeated. And the other authors that I mentioned to you, these are people that I know, and they wanted to test outside of this ramification, which is this limitation, which is totally appropriate. And whenever we apply this to the general population, the Medicare population, there are, you know, I treat T1 to T4 two or three times a week. So this is something that really comes up.
What about above that even?
Well, that, you know, above that, that's a very good question. That's a very, very good question. Above that, it doesn't really apply necessarily, because we have the ability to do vertebroplasty is defined as cervical thoracic. So vertebroplasty is defined cervical thoracic and lumbosacral. So the ability to treat the patients in terms of a vertebroplasty of the cervical spine still seems to be supported. And however this is done, that I also agree with that. These are not very common. Cervical vertebroplasties, I've done thousands and thousands of general, but maybe only about 25 cervical cases. But when you do them, they're typically myeloma. I mean, these are patients that have very severe problems. So they don't happen very often, but they do happen. Right. And typically they're covered by the cervical thoracic vertebroplasty code, because you don't do vertebral augmentation necessarily in the cervical spine.
Gotcha. Dr. Beal, thank you for your comments.
Very well. Thank you.
Operator, if we could now go to Dr. Levy and open his line.
Hi there. I am Dr. Jason Levy, and I am representing the Society of Interventional Radiology. I appreciate the ability to speak regarding the proposed LCD, and I also appreciate the changes getting rid of the multidisciplinary requirement, which was really unnecessary. I do want to address some shortcomings in the existing LCD. If we could go to the next slide. Briefly, my disclosures are listed here. The only one that's really relevant is the Medtronic disclosure. Next slide. So I'm going to be focusing on what we're supposed to be discussing during the comment period, but I will address some of the things that Dr. Beal discussed as well. I'm going to start with the age of the fracture. Next slide. So unfortunately, right now, we have it on the proposed LCD at up to 12 weeks. The challenge with this is there's really two to three things that are problematic. One, it's unclear. Two, it's unrealistic. And three, it's essentially unsupported. So from a clarity standpoint and a realistic standpoint, there is not always a defining event. So we have to look at this clinically and from imaging. From a clinical perspective, we do not have a defined event in many times. This is not a motor vehicle accident. It is a low-impact trauma. Sometimes it can be elicited simply by a cough. The patients are elderly and don't always give us a specific date. So timing of this is really, truly unrealistic. The other challenge with this is we know we have definitive data from VIRTOS 2, VIRTOS 4, VAPOR trial, Papanastasiou meta-analysis, that these fractures aren't a one-time event. They fracture, and then they fracture again in the same vertebral body. That further challenges any type of dating. When we look at most of the literature, we should be focusing on advanced imaging, and that is one of the criteria that came out of the RAND study. Okay, we should be focusing on criteria. Attached to this are seven references looking at edema on advanced MRI as really the most important feature or one of many important features rather than focusing on time. So the next slide. So I looked, the LCD referred to six references, and I looked at each of these references as far as where is your source for this. So if you're going to exclude older fractures, I request the source. Now, Dr. Beal mentioned a bunch of sources that support chronic fracture treatment, but I don't really see a source that doesn't. So the bar, no. There was only a mention against the initial mandatory waiting period, which you have gotten rid of. The RAND study, in fact, went the exact opposite direction, and I highlighted this. The panel's treatment recommendation did not vary substantially with time. In fact, they focused on what I suggest is focusing more on advanced imaging findings rather than timing. Next slide, please. The McConnell, again, on the contrary, it actually suggests subacute. Again, no timing described. I will get to the Clark reference in a second. DeLisi, no. And Tsumakadu, which is actually the CIRSE guidelines, on the contrary, supports chronic non-union fracture, similar to what we would do with a non-union fracture anywhere else in the body. So, again, that is one out of six, and this one, let's look at that further in depth because it's not really a supporting an exclusion. It actually was not a study, but instead a response to an errant Cochrane database. And it certainly didn't suggest that fractures can't be treated greater than 12 weeks, but instead suggested that potentially fractures in the three failed sham trials, which is not what these patients are getting, they're getting non-surgical management, but those three failed sham trials That was related to including chronic fractures. Now, you have to remember, in one of those sham trials, they did not include MRIs, and in another one of the sham trials, the MRI's timing related to the fractures was unclear. Let's go to the next slide, please. There certainly is evidence out there to the contrary. Here's a sampling of that. Dr. Beal mentioned more, but these are randomized controlled trials, and as well as single-arm prospective trial. That should say greater than 3 months on the bottom. That is a typo on my part. Excuse me for that. But the bottom line is there is certainly evidence to the contrary. So I'm going to skip on to some of the other topics that are not part of this comment period, but I do think that they're important enough to discuss. The first is the exclusion of T1 through T4. This is completely unsupported, and I assume, again, this may be a concern related to safety concerns, but again, that is unsupported as well. So I would ask the NGS to be giving us support for why that it was excluded, and I did hear that it wasn't included in some of the trials, although there are trials where it has been included, although not as frequently, and that is in part because it doesn't happen as often in that area. Having said that, there were 6 references that the LCD included. Did those references mention exclusion of T1 through 4? And that was 0 for 6, so not a single one mentioned it as an exclusion, and in fact, the CIRSE recommendation was given and procedural approaches for the upper T-spine. The next item I want to address is the number of fractures. We've already talked about how unclear this wording is. For instance, if a patient has a report in a chronic MRI with 3 chronic fractures and a 4th acute fracture, this would exclude this patient. And I did hear you say, and I agree with you, there are some safety concerns. However, that number 3 is sort of a somewhat arbitrary number, and there are safety concerns with non-surgical management. We know that patients go on to fracture. In fact, some of the patients in the Virtus 4 study went on to fracture and became paralyzed related to that. There are significant risks to non-surgical management, such as deconditioning. So we have to balance the cardiopulmonary risks of treating multiple levels versus the risks of treating non-surgical management. So like I said, the 6 references that were, I'm sorry, on this, there were 5 references. Again, 0 for 5 excluded the number of fractures. In fact, the CIRSE recommendation was 5, not 3. So we have to balance these patients. There are studies who have looked at, and you can see that in my slide deck that is not shown here, but there are studies that have looked at this and have shown very similar safety profiles. There has been a suggestion of no more than 5 or 6. There has been a suggestion of no more than 30 cc's of cement, but we need to, number one, clarify that it's not more than 3. We need to, that cannot be an absolute contraindication. There may be a way to get around this by suggesting staged procedures where 3 or 4 at a time are treated, but we can't let the most high-risk population for complications related to deconditioning go untreated. This exclusion leaves a large portion of the Medicare population untreated. So the final comment that I want to make is we're in an opioid epidemic. And this wasn't listed here, but we're in an opioid epidemic. The fact that opioids, which is the alternative here, is not listed as one of the indications. So if somebody is on chronic opioids and having unacceptable side effects, that is mentioned in every single society guideline that is one of the LCD references. And every one of them, it mentions for a patient with a weakened or fractured vertebral body, unacceptable side effects such as excessive sedation, confusion, or constipation should be an indication. So in that table where you list progression of vertebral body height loss greater than 25%, we need to add that as a 4th possible indication, allowing for 2 of the 4 rather than 2 of the 3 indications. So to sum it up, we need to get rid of the we need to allow for more chronic fractures, especially if they have edema. We need to get rid of the exclusion from T1 through T4. We need to get rid of the three vertebral fractures. We need to clarify the language and allow for treatment in the sick population and allow for the physicians to balance the risks. And then finally, I think we need to concern ourselves with our opioid use and the alternative of what these patients are really getting and allow that to be an indication for this procedure. So I thank you for your time, and if there are any questions, I am happy to answer them.
Dr. Levy, thanks for your comments. Just a few things. I think as far as the three fracture limit and the T5, DEL5, the inclusion criteria on virtually every major study. I think the references that you looked at weren't specifically coupled to those. They may have been nearby, but they weren't specifically coupled to those things. If you look at Vapor, Virtos 4, Virtos 2, Invest, Bootbinder, Free, Evolve, and even the upcoming Virtos 5, they all have those same limitations, for better or worse. And as I already spoke to, I think the three fracture is somewhat of a misunderstanding in that my interpretation was it wasn't a lifetime, it was a at the same time issue. Yes, there are beyond that, there's a case to be made that even at the same time, more than three, but that's a different issue. The T5 to L5, again, that's in all the studies. The reasons for it, Dr. Beal, unlike the fracture limitation, the safety, there wasn't a cogent explanation. I'll have to see why all those studies did the same thing. Usually things aren't arbitrary in these studies. They do it for a reason. Your first comment that you made as far as these things aren't a momentous event. They can be just as a cough or something like that. That's true. And so it's not as memorable in that respect. But I was a little surprised by this because it frankly never occurred to me that was going to be a big issue to note the onset of the fracture, because usually that's associated with symptoms. And I think virtually all the studies count it that way, the onset of symptoms. So, and that, even if the cough wasn't memorable, the onset of symptoms probably are. So I'm not sure that that's as much of an issue. We could certainly clarify that that's related to the onset of symptoms. It may have been that it seemed so obvious that we didn't even specify it. And one thing I also want to mention was, and I should have mentioned this to Dr. Beal, he made a big case of the data for the chronic being equivalent to the acute and subacute, and he put a lot of weight on the Virtos 5. Virtos 5 is not yet published. And my discussion with the actual authors on that, they're not giving out any information on that. And they recommend not acting on anything like that until it's published. And certainly we don't take into consideration any evidence that isn't published in peer-reviewed journal. So there's that. That's going to be published probably later this year or early next year, but it's certainly not published yet. And I don't think I brought that out with Dr. Beal's comments, and it's certainly important. When that does come out, that will have some of the same limitations that were held against Virtos 4, and we'll see what that data shows. It's an important study, and that we certainly look forward to getting that information. I think that's all I had as far as in response. Did you have anything you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to some of those. For starters, one of the common themes here is you are referring to absolute contraindications, and you're saying these are absolute contraindications because in many of the studies they were not included. That is never an absolute contraindication, which is what you are suggesting here, and that is a dangerous implication in the setting where there is definitive mortality benefits from this procedure. So I think that is an unfair comment when we're saying that it is an absolute contraindication. So let's start with that. Second, as a person who has treated thousands of patients, you are well off the mark on the timing perspective. You cannot time these fractures. And we have definitive evidence that these fractures, like I said earlier, there is Virtuos 2, Virtuos 4, vapor trial. We know these fractures will fracture and fracture again. So even if you try the onset of symptoms, that can't happen. Your alternative, you're putting these patients on opioids, and that's not going to help us remember these fracture timing. So if a patient comes in and we think the timing was 11 weeks and 6 days ago, we have 1 day to get this patient on the table. It is absurd to think in a real-world population that that is relevant. Finally, the reference that the levels, some of these studies did not, they just said thoracic or lumbar. They did not always indicate whether it was T5. I believe one of the major randomized controlled studies did include T4. But again, you are leaving the highest at-risk population. They're very rare when you compare it to junctional areas between T9 and L3, but they happen. And right now we have significant information on mortality. So I think we need to take a step back when we're calling something an absolute contraindication or leaving it completely out, completely uncovered, when there's really no support to use it as a risk. And that goes, again, for the number of three levels. You know, all of the society recommendations, there's no three levels in there. That's fairly arbitrary. So I will leave my comments on that. And finally, with the mortality discussion, when we look at that, and I will submit the references for mortality. There was just another one published in Radiology earlier this year, so that will be included as well. But when you look at that, that's looking at Medicare data. So that's not necessarily stopping at three levels. I have personally treated multiple patients with many more than three levels, as I'm sure every speaker that's going to discuss has as well. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Dr. Levy. Our next registered speaker is Dr. Chouinard. Operator, if you could open his line. Dr. Chouinard, are you there?
Is the line open? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I just wanted to ask Craig if you'd remind me at the end of my presentation, I can address a cogent explanation for each of the issues that you raised, because really what you're trying to do is find objective criteria for indications. That's what you're trying to do. You're looking for onset of symptoms. You're looking for acuity. You're trying to figure out T5 to L5 and three levels, or why not all fractures. What is this business with chronic fractures? You're just looking for indications, and I can understand that. So I'm an orthopedic fellowship-trained spine surgeon. I'm the founding clinician who's responsible for the vertebral compression fracture registry done in collaboration with Bernice Hecker, Dick Whitten, Gary Oakes, and Eileen, in conjunction with a data vendor to develop the registry. And this collaboration has produced the largest VCF registry in the world, and it has given significant insight into healthcare utilization. And since the VCF registry and the healthcare utilization data reflect Noridian's 2014 LCD, it applies to all MACs because this is your data. These are your beneficiaries. So let me click and go next slide. And I'll just power through this. So you know where it was done. Those are it was in jurisdiction ZNF. You know who the principals are. The next slide, the authorization criteria did address acuity, and I can tell you how, because what you're looking for is an objective measure, and I can tell you how to get that done. The three levels was arbitrary and capricious, as others have said, and it was based on the two collaborating physicians in the original collaboration, me and Bernice. So remember, Bernice Hecker, the medical director of Noridian at the time and since married and now retired, Bernice was anesthesia trained, and I'm a fellowship-trained spine surgeon. So both Bernice and I knew that when you turn a patient prone, you're going to have blood pressure problems. And in this age group, which is almost always dehydrated, our concern was safety. So Bernice and I agreed that you should not do more than three for safety purposes, and that's three per episode. She and I did not have any valid scientific justification for it, but we thought it clinically wise. Both she and I are senior clinicians. So that was an arbitrary, and that's what we did, and that's the cogent understanding. If, as I understand your implication, that as a safety measure, we might retain the three levels per treatment episode and then leave to the clinician, treating clinician, the decision of when to proceed with the others, I could align with that. But I also understand that this is not scientifically based. The three levels is capricious and arbitrary, as Doug and Jason have mentioned. So I'm going to go to the next slide on mine. And intended time, remember, this was a coverage with evidence development purpose that we collaborated around. And it involved surveillance tracking, and it gave insights. It actually resolved the controversy. The next slide will show that the immediate impacts were a restriction of access. It's important to understand this because your proposed LCD will do this. In Washington, only 6 out of 310 were authorized. In Montana, 0 out of 100 were authorized in the early 2014. And there was also a clawback, but I'm not going to go into clawback. Next slide. So what you see, the intended results of this were the world's largest VCF registry, the resolution of controversy around treatment, and now the Europeans are approaching us to help them understand that more completely. What you find, and you'll see in the data slides, that this is the most beneficial a treatment option for these patients with the greatest amount of pain and function improvement. Next slide. There's the data. Embedded in the slides are the red zone at the top of each graph line. That's your MCID. That's your minimal clinically important difference. And although these are slides that are showing populations rather than individuals, I put the MCID in there so that you could realize, my God, the pain improvement is 5 times the MCID, and the functional improvement is 3 times the MCID. So these are hugely beneficial, and this is for the largest population recorded. So let's go to the next slide. When you look at healthcare utilizations, these were done. All of these patients are registry patients. All of them are reflected in the outcomes, and what you see is all costs affiliated with the index ICD-9 vertebral compression fracture code. And the next slide shows that it breaks into 3 categories, early, intermediate, and late. And when you look at the next slide, you'll see the early and the late. And this is the important thing to understand here, is the benefits of this collaboration are hugely insightful for you as a MAC. What you see here is if the patient is diagnosed early and treated promptly, the dysfunction in their Roland Morris, which is significant, 20, improves to 3. That is grandma dancing across the floor. 20 is grandma bedridden, hospice-level care. So there's dramatic improvement. The pain improvement from 8 goes to 1. Now look at if you delay care. The LCD will delay care. So what happens? So this is 171 is days is 6 months. Your cost triples, mostly because of return to ED, readmission, MRI, CT. Notice they're still severely disabled. So non-surgical care isn't working. And they improve dramatically, 2 times MCID, but not as much as if you did their treatment immediately. Their pain improvement is dramatic, but not as much. So what does that mean? That means that the patient who waits is harmed, measurably harmed, by the objective criteria that we collaborated to demonstrate whether this was coverage with evidence. And so let's go to the next slide. Unintended and intended consequences. Number one, PVA is the safest, most beneficial treatment you can do. And every level responded, even those where I did three and then I waited a week, made sure patient was doing well cardiovascularly, and then did the next two afterward. They all responded beautifully. So every level of vertebral compression fracture, independent of cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral, every level responds to appropriate treatment reproducibly. The prompt treatment is the greatest benefit at the lowest cost, and delayed treatment results in debility, destitution, death, and the highest cost for the MAC. Next slide, please. So, unintended consequences, if you use LCD the way that you have it now outlined, you are going to delay care. So, the periosteal infiltration violates all orthopedic fracture principles. It should be discarded. Last slide. What happens with this? So, yeah, you are familiar with a class of individuals, vulnerable individuals, and the reference to this is the smoking lawsuits, the breast implant lawsuits, the contaminated community water supply. If you have a whole class of vulnerable beneficiaries whose care is delayed, you're exposing the MAC to enormous liability. And the findings of the Noridian LCD are now public knowledge. So to say this another way, the unintended consequences of the Noridian LCD in 2014 was that Noridian discovered a resoundingly beneficial way to treat the painful osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture, and it resolved a treatment controversy. Secondly, Noridian discovered an expedited pathway for compassionate care for their beneficiaries. And thirdly, Noridian received the opportunity to achieve massive healthcare utilization cost savings by improving efficiency of care. The LCD is a barrier to the improvement of efficiency of care. And now lastly, let me reflect on some of the concerns you had, cogent explanations you were seeking, because really that's, you know, give me objective criteria for indications. And Bernice and I were committed to accomplishing this, and Dick Whitten participated in some of these discussions. So acuity cannot be defined by date of injury, because these women, as had been reflected earlier, independent of the studies that you were quoting, Craig, these women do not have a grasp of when this started, and their husbands, if they are still alive and still with them, they don't remember when this started. And their daughters, who are usually taking care of them, they're the ones who bring them in, they don't know, but grandma just started deteriorating. So what Bernice and I did is we said, look, what's the MRI or the bone scan? Because some of these folks are on pacers, then you can't MRI them. What is the criteria for acuity radiologically? Well, for MRI, acute fractures remain positive on STIR for 4 to 6 months. So notice in the Noridian LCD, treatment was allowed up to 6 months, and that's based on our agreement around an objective criteria. Doug and Jason are precisely correct that the chronic fractures respond, but they don't have a STIR signal abnormality. So if you use MRI as a hard definer of indication, you will fail to get to those patients. So what Bernice and I came up with is, actually Courtney Brown from Denver came up with this, and then I shared it with Bernice, is you use a localizing X-ray. I use a paperclip. And part of the physical exam is I put the paperclip where the patient is painful. And every single time, it's on top of the vertebral compression fracture, except the older female who has spondylolisthesis, because she also hurts at L4-5. And it'll end up down there. But if there's no vertebral compression fracture down there, that problem is mechanical back pain from spinal stenosis and spondylolisthesis. But the localizing X-ray is an objective measure of the location of pain. And if it's over a chronic vertebral compression fracture, that fracture needs to be treated. The T5L5, that arises from Alex Vaccaro's pedicle screw fixation technique in the late 90s. Alex was my junior resident while I was a fellow at Rothman. And pedicle screw fixation from T1 to T5, really T1 to T4, because that's where Bernice and I settled is, on T4 as the upper limit. And that was because of safety. Using fluoroscopy, you cannot see the upper pedicles as easily, so you have to be skilled, which is why Doug Beal does it. That's why Jason does it. That's why I do it. We're skilled at doing this. We know how to do it. The scapula of the shoulder blades gets in the way, particularly in the obese patient. But that was a safety issue.
We've exceeded time.
All right. Then cogent explanations if you wish. Craig, I'll leave that to you.
Cogent explanations for?
So the points that I have marked out is chronic vertebral compression fracture, and I address that with a localizing X-ray. For levels, cervical thoracic, lumbosacral, I address that by saying that all fractures are painful and all fractures should be promptly treated. The three levels, I address that with the conversation of Bernice and I around the safety of elderly women being prone. The T5L5, I just got finished explaining. And the objective criteria with regard to onset of symptoms was something that Bernice and I struggled with, and so we settled on a radiographic criteria for MRI, but the radiographic criteria for MRI will not allow you the flexibility to treat the chronically painful vertebral compression fracture because the stir image will have gone cold by then, just as the bone scan will have gone cold by then, and that's where you can substitute a localizing X-ray indicating the level of the painful vertebral compression fracture, and that will allow you to treat the chronic vertebral compression fracture based on objective criteria or indications. That's what I'm reliving the conversations that Bernice and I had when we first set, and Dick Whitten and I had when we first set up the vertebral compression fracture registry.
And Dr. Chouinard, I mean, virtually every study gauged acuity by time from pain onset.
Yes, and this is the largest study in the world, and I can tell you that a little old lady doesn't have a firm date of onset. And Jason inferred it, that they go through an initial vertebral compression fracture, they develop pain, they don't get to see their doctor for 4 to 6 weeks. They get in and, oh, I'm feeling better now, and they then go on to subsequently compress and develop what's called vertebra plana. Think of it as a recycled can of Coke. If you step on it partially collapses. If you shift your full weight onto it, it flattens like a pancake. That's what happens to these women sequentially. So putting a date of onset is irrational, and the registry proves that it is not reliable.
Dr. Chouinard, thank you for your comments.
Oh, glad to help.
Operator, if we could see if there are anybody else who has comments on this policy.
Absolutely. If you do have comments or a question, please press star 1. Once again, if you do have comments or a question, please press star 1. We do have a question from Heather. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to get some clarification on this new policy or the revision of this policy. My question has to do with the 4 diagnosis, all saying osteoporosis. Prior to this change, a good majority of the patients we saw were osteopenia by classification. Is osteopenia no longer included as an acceptable diagnosis? And the reason I asked this, when I was reviewing the VIRTOS 4 criteria, they included T-scores negative 1 past negative 2.5.
Thank you for that comment. I really haven't had any comments related to that. I think I had one, and it may have been from you via email. So it's sort of a unique comment. My impression was that the data has been related to osteoporosis, not osteopenia. But I'd be interested to have you send in a comment that includes references to the studies that you think included osteopenia.
So the Virtus 4, they asked that I clarify on my email. They actually, so what I did when I sent the second email, I used the same Virtus 4 citation from the policy list. And in their criteria, it spells out, like, the T-score they used was negative 1 being the cutoff, but that, in fact, is osteopenia by definition. So my next question would be, how do I just resend that email for them to reconsider that diagnosis?
Well, I would say, for one thing, Virtus 4 didn't show a benefit, so that's one. Secondly, if that's one study, if you could look at some of the other major studies and see if they also included those patients. Again, this is sort of an isolated comment from my perspective, and not that it's not valid, but I just haven't looked into it. But
no,
I would welcome,
absolutely. I will.
Greg, can I answer a little of that?
Who's speaking?
That's Dr. Levy. Can I answer a little of that?
Sure. Go ahead, Dr. Levy.
Sure. So two things. Virtus 4 actually did show a benefit. You're just comparing it. It didn't show a benefit compared to a sham, which we don't know
right.
Dr. Levy,
if we could just stick to the osteopenia versus osteoporosis question.
I think most people believe that, well, you had said that, so I wanted to clarify a misstatement. But I think most people.
I don't think that's a misstatement. Those are the official published results. But let's stick with the osteopenia versus osteoporosis.
Okay. Well, the official published results did show a benefit in that population. But the difference between osteopenia and osteoporosis, and I think Dr. Chouinard would agree, in a low-impact situation, regardless of what the bone density study shows, that's typically an osteoporosis-defining event. So a low-impact vertebral compression deformity or fracture is, you know, obviously in the absence of a cancer or other diagnosis that you guys have already talked about, is an osteoporosis-defining event. I don't think that the majority of these patients have had a definitive osteoporosis diagnosis based on bone densitometry. In fact, the vast majority of them have not, and that's not currently an indication. So I think that's how I would personally read this, and I would be interested to hear Dr. Chouinard's opinion.
May I add to that what you just said? So in our clinic, the majority of our patients have, in fact, had DEXA scans, and if they come to me with a fracture, that's one of the first things I do in addition to further workup is to get a DEXA scan. And what I've seen over the past, well, since December especially, I'm having patients return who've had kyphoplasty prior to, or vertebral augmentation prior to the December change. They're returning with a new fracture. Their DEXA scan says osteopenia, and now they no longer qualify. So I'm seeing them show with osteopenia. Just to add that, I know that doesn't have to do with our question, but I'm seeing them with osteopenia with fractures. So my second question, based on what you just said, if I don't want to misdiagnose anyone because I don't want to be audited and on the hot seat, in a case where they show with osteopenia and they have a fracture, is it acceptable for me to use the osteoporosis diagnosis code for these women for vertebral augmentation?
The osteoporosis codes or osteopenia codes?
Well, there are no osteopenia codes. The only two or four options I have, one is osteoporosis, initial one is osteoporosis, subsequent, and then the other two are other osteoporosis.
Yeah. Again, this is a the first time I've really been exposed to this comment or request. If you could survey the studies out there and see if the majority of the studies support your coverage of osteopenia, I think that's where I'd recommend you start.
No, that I'm happy to do that. I appreciate you entertaining my question.
Yes. Thank you for your comment.
No, thank you.
Operator, do we have any others? Operator.
We have no other questions or comments at this time.
Okay, then we will be closing the open meeting comments on percutaneous vertebral augmentation for osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures. The next policy is revision to the existing water vapor thermal therapy for LUTS DPH policy. This is, as I said, an existing LCD related to minimally invasive thermal treatment of DPH, in which we made this simple revision of deleting urinary retention as a contraindication. This change was made secondary to the publication of retrospective analysis showing the procedure to be a viable alternative for treatment of catheter-dependent urinary retention, especially in elderly and frail patients at higher risk for anesthesia and more invasive surgical approaches. We don't have any registered commenters for this policy. Operator, can you ask if there are any other comments on this?
Yes, absolutely. Once again, if there are any comments, please press star 1, and I will open your line. Once again, if there are any comments, please press star 1. Once again, as a reminder, if you have any comments or questions, please press star 1. We have nothing coming through at this time, Doctor.
Okay, thank you. If there are no comments on this, the comments for this policy during this open meeting will now be closed. The next policy up for discussion is a new policy, computed tomography, cerebral perfusion analysis, CTP. cerebral perfusion analysis, CTP, uses a sequence of head CTs after a contrast bolus to measure various hemodynamic parameters related to cerebral blood flow. These metrics help distinguish brain regions with a high probability of irreversible infarction, the so-called ischemic core, from areas with potentially reversible ischemia, so-called penumbra. Two recent major RCTs, both published in the New England Journal, found that CTP helped determine eligibility for endovascular thrombectomy in the late time period, that being 6 to 24 hours after acute ischemic stroke. Both trials demonstrated a large clinical benefit with numbers needed to treat of 3 to 4 to prevent functional dependence. Next slide, please. These are the key inclusion criteria of the two studies. Both focus on those patients that seem to have either clinical symptoms or reversible ischemia out of proportion to the volume of irreversible infarction, a clinical core or penumbra core mismatch, so to speak. In other words, those patients that may have more salvageable brain if a thrombectomy is performed and perfusion restored. Epidemiologic data suggests that about 1/3 of acute ischemic stroke patients present during this late time period, 6 to 24 hours, and only 9.2% of these, or 2.7% overall, meet either DAWN or DIFFUSE 3 inclusion criteria. Next slide. This slide shows the draft coverage criteria, which basically require strict adherence to either the DAWN or diffuse protocol, as recommended by the latest AHA-ASA guidelines. Other stroke or non-stroke indications for CTP lack level 1 evidence and are not considered medically reasonable or necessary at this time. Again, we don't have any registered commenters on this policy. Operator, can you see if there are any other comments?
If you have any comments on this policy, please press star 1. Once again, if you would like to comment on this, please press star 1. Again, as a reminder, if you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 and record your name. Doctor, we have no questions or comments coming through at this time.
Thank you, operator. So the comments on this policy for this open meeting are now closed. If you could go to the next slide. The official comment period ends on July 18th this year for these five policies. And next slide. That may be the last one. Actually, that's the last slide. So thank you, all the presenters and other commenters today for attending our open meeting. And operator, I think that will be the end of our open meeting.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.